then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's January the 24th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, to begin with, I'm going to suggest an organizing tip to you guys out there who are of a mind to do something practical to help the party. Every week when I complete Radio Free Northwest, before I upload it to the site, I listen to the podcast first by burning a CD of it, so I can sit and just listen to it in an out-of-cyberspace environment kind of thing, looking for mistakes or technical glitches, seeing how the show actually sounds to the naked ear, so forth and so on. Now, it may surprise some of you to learn that there are still people in our movement who do not own or understand personal computers, and who have never heard Radio Free Northwest. Obviously, since you're hearing this, you're not one of them, but that does limit our audience for RFN, and we need to see if we can do something about that. Now, many of these PC-less comrades are elderly. They grew up before computers in their present form were invented, before Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, and they see no reason for the old dog to try and learn new tricks now. Some of them are in prison, and some people have simply decided that they don't want these goddamn machines and the madness these machines produce in their lives, and they voluntarily turn their computers off and pack them back in the box and put them away in a closet or whatever. I have an immense amount of respect for people who can do that, and if anything, we need to be making a special effort to reach the kind of white people who have that kind of personal strength and discipline to swim against the current, so to speak. I've developed a habit of sending these individual CDs that I personally make of the weekly podcast to this one comrade in Pennsylvania who doesn't have a computer, and every now and then he writes to me and tells me what a difference it's made now that he can listen to me and not just read my words on paper, how he's playing and lending the RFN CDs I send him to other people who don't have computers, so forth and so on. As you know from my periodic bitching and moaning, the Northwest Front has no general headquarters unit, and we have no staff. Neither do we have any kind of centralized propaganda unit to produce printed and audiovisual material. That day will come when we can centralize all this and supply anyone who wants it with masses of literature and CDs and a tabloid newspaper, so forth and so on. But that day is not yet. Now, I don't have the time or really the gear to burn CD after CD every week and send them to a list of the non-computerized. Producing multiple copies of them on my own PC would be a slow and cumbersome process, and I couldn't really make all that many of them. But if each of you listening to this would download the podcast every week, burn a few CDs of it, or maybe even make flash drive copies, and then pass those CDs or flash drives on to people who don't have computers, or who need to be introduced to the Northwest Imperative, then that would immensely widen the ripple that we're able to make in the pale blob when we throw our little stones into the creature to try and get some kind of response. And most people have some kind of CD recorder that they can play these RFN casts on, even if it's only some old boombox they picked up somewhere, or the CD player in their car. Now, if you don't know anyone to send these to, but you know how to burn CDs, then make a couple every week and just send them to me. I have a list of non-computer people who would love to be able to hear Radio Free Northwest every week. Now, this is something that you can do while continuing to sit behind your computer in Ohio or Florida or Maryland or Arizona. So it's a great way to salve your conscience for not doing what we all know that you really should be doing, which is packing a moving van and getting your pale ass up here. By making a few CDs every week, you can be part of the magic and console yourself that you're doing your duty to the Northwest Republic. Well, sort of. But burning a CD or two every week doesn't involve any risk or inconvenience, and unfortunately for all too many white boys these days, that's a draw. Seriously, guys, this is an easy thing to do. It won't cost you hardly anything or any time, and there is really very little excuse for not doing it, although I'm sure I'll hear some doozies. Okay, email time. This is from my old buddy Lewis Hall back in North Carolina. Not the whole email, but I'll read you part of it. Quote, Harold, as impressed as I am with what you've done over the past 15 years since you left, especially the novels you've written, I still don't see any real change in the central problem, which is that the overwhelming majority of white people are simply dead weight. I know your theory on active revolutionary minorities, but haven't you ever heard of lifeguards who end up drowning when they try to get a corpse to shore or into a boat? The dead weight simply drags them down and they drown too. Okay, yes, I'll grant you, Lewis, that the Jews have created a dead weight in the mass of white people, an inert mass. They did this deliberately in order to make sure that whites will never wake up sufficiently to resist them, just like they're now trying to confiscate the kind of semi-automatic firearm that might be used to resist them. But when the time comes, if we work this right, it will be like jiu-jitsu. We will use the enemy's own dead weight against him. By which I mean the dead weight, the inert mass of dumbed-down white people, or low-information voters, as Rush Limbaugh calls them. The great pale blob that the Jew himself has created. The great mass of white people who have been taught from birth to watch from a seated position while events unfold around them. For the past 60 years, the left liberal media have conditioned white people to be spectators and not participants. People who sit on the couch watching the big game while swilling beer and eating salty snacks instead of being out on the field actually getting all sweaty and dirty and exercising their muscles. And in the end, the kikes are going to regret doing that. Yes, the Jews achieved their objective. The great pale blob is in such a state of ignorance and apathy and physical unfitness that they most likely will never actively revolt against the dictatorship or resist it. But neither will they actively oppose or resist us. Those 60 years of social engineering in order to create a great white inert mass will be turned against the regime who did it. Remember, we're talking about three whole generations of white people, especially white males, who have been taught that life and politics and events and reality are things that you sit in an armchair or on a sofa or behind a computer and watch unfold on an electronic screen. If and when my novels ever do come to pass, and there is an NVA out there shooting and blowing things up, how do you really think most Americans will react? Now, to most of them, it will simply be one more case of what's on the tube tonight or something to yak about online in various ways. What we will end up with is a conflict between the 5% of the population that supports us out of a desire for freedom and change, and the 5% of the population who supports the United States in order to preserve their power and their money or just keep their government medical insurance. That's pretty much the way things were during the first American Revolution as well. Okay, now I want to talk about something else, which is one of those topics I'm going to have to kind of slide around the edges on with a lot of nudge, nudge, wink, wink, read between the lines kind of thing, because of who's listening to this podcast. I will try to be as clear as I possibly can about what I want to say, but because we do have unwanted and uninvited neighbors eavesdropping on us over the back fence, I won't be able to be too specific. So this will be a general rambling discourse, which I hope will convey my meaning. Now, some of you pointed out that there seems to be some contradiction between some of the things I've been telling you about how to get organized in your area of the homeland, how to form a cell or activity group, how public you should go, and under what circumstances. It seems like one minute I'm urging you to get out and do this, do that, and draw attention to yourselves in the name of the Northwest Front so we can get some system publicity. And the next minute, I'm warning you all to be careful and keep your heads down because of the risks of infiltration or simply picking up dysfunctional and undesirable people. Remember the Edgar Steele case, so forth and so on. I understand that this sometimes sounds contradictory, and sometimes it is contradictory. Let me explain this as best I can. The Northwest Front is a legal movement that must act as though it were an illegal one. You will note I don't say organization, I use the term movement, and I think maybe it's time we started differentiating between the Northwest Independence Movement and the so-called movement with a capital M that I've been babbling about for all these years. But think about what I just said, because it's essential that you all grasp this and act on it, if only so you don't get hurt. We are a legal movement who must behave as if we were an illegal one. Now, we have every right under the United States Constitution to speak and write and believe as we do, and to discuss issues and events and advocate ideas in public. But the present one-party dictatorship that rules the United States does not want us to exercise those rights. This is the same attitude that the dictatorship has towards the Second Amendment. Technically speaking, you still have the right to keep and bear arms. But the government does not want you to exercise that right. And so they place all kinds of laws and ordinances and rules and now imperial decrees in the form of presidential executive orders in the way, in order to prevent white Americans from exercising that right. As with the Second Amendment, so with the First. The attitude that the dictatorship takes towards us and to all white dissidents is, yes, we do still have this silly Constitution thing hanging around that we can't quite seem to get rid of yet. So until we do, the regime tells us, you may exist, but you cannot function. Technically, we have the right to speak and to write and associate with whomever you like and express whatever views we want to object on any subject, anytime, anywhere. Technically. In real life, if we attempt in any way to do so, or if we attempt to act on our racial and political views in any way, bad things start to happen to us. I won't go into exactly what, because most of you know. We've been over all this before, and I'm talking about this to fight paranoia, not to spread it. Let's just say the Edgar Steele case is an extreme example. Now, in the middle of this kind of situation, and in the middle of a clearly encroaching one-party dictatorship in very bad times altogether, I am asking many of you to take at least a few steps out from behind the computer to try and get some organizing done and make some progress for the Northwest Front. This involves talking to other people and, in essence, revealing yourselves as racial heretics, and that can be dangerous. I'm asking you to do things that will make it impossible for you to maintain complete secrecy as to your identity, and which will expose you to, well, exposure. Now, I could tell you that thanks to the FBI carnivore program and all the bullshit that's gone on since 9/11, everybody who has even the mildest dissident thought left or right is already on some kind of government list, and it's pointless to try and hide. But I don't think most of you can get your arms around that, not really. Most of you have had no overt signs that you're being watched or that your ID is in fact known to the regime, and so you probably continue to kid yourselves that they don't know who you are. Well, in fact, they do know who you are. It's just that with all the millions of Americans who have expressed dissent over the past 11 years, they haven't gotten around to rattling your cage yet, especially if you remained passive like a good white boy had oughta. But, okay, you're an American, and you don't get it. Of all the things that you can waste your time doing, trying to conceal from the Obama dictatorship that you have white racial thoughts is probably the most futile. Now, we're dealing with a massive government apparatus, the entire purpose of which is to detect and catalog and analyze every faint hint of racial dissent in American society, especially since the Department of Homeland Security was formed and became the major information gathering agency. In fact, that's pretty much all DHS does, is to monitor human activity, gather information, store it, and analyze it. What the hell do you think those thousands of intelligence analysts and those huge databases in the fortified facilities in West Virginia are for? Okay, let me wrench myself back on the track here, back to what I'm supposed to be talking about. First off, we have to do something about, well, about all this crap that's going on. I assume that you agree with that statement or you wouldn't be listening to the show. Now, the problem is that you want someone else to do it. You think I or someone else has some magic beans in their pocket and we can suddenly make it all go away without you yourself undergoing any risk or inconvenience. I suspect all of you know deep down that's impossible, and you understand that your own personal fear and unwillingness to incur any risk or inconvenience is why the movement has failed in the past and will continue to fail, at least a very large part of that reason. In other words, you know the score. Now, the question is, how brave can you force yourself to be in spite of everything? in spite of your upbringing, in spite of all of the mental and emotional baggage that you're carrying. I know that most of you won't even try. You'll listen to this podcast and then click off until it's time to tune in again next week. That's us. That's white boys. That's who most of us are, and it's what we do. I get it. I understand what I'm asking you to do. I'm asking you to break training. I am asking you to take a few overt acts that will bump you up on the DHS list, that will cause you to ping the detectors in that database in West Virginia, and all of a sudden you're not just a series of archived emails and blog posts. You're on the radar as somebody who has actually done something overt, maybe even physical, off the internet. Yes, that's dangerous. I get it. I am not asking you to do anything stupid. I am not asking you to do anything unlawful. I am not asking you to kill anybody or burn anything down or bomb anything. I am not asking you to do anything that will get you fired from your job, which is the main penalty that America extracts from white people who dissent. But I am asking you to do things that involve the exercise of constitutional rights, which in theory you possess, but which in practice the government of the United States and its armed men do not want you to exercise. That's dangerous. I get it. Can I guarantee you that you won't be persecuted or harassed or harmed in any way by the dictatorship? No, I can't. So why the hell should you do what I say? I am asking you to do these things for the front, perfectly legal but dangerous, because it is right. No other reason. I am asking you to do these things because white people are being reduced to a modern version of slavery, in which we will be the property not of an individual master but of the state. That is wrong and evil. And the people from Barack Hussein Obama on down who are doing this are evil. I am asking you to help me resist them, because resisting evil is right. It's what white boys do, or what we used to do, and it's what we need to start doing again. I know that all of you understand that what I'm telling you here is the truth. None of us has been so badly rewired and socially engineered that we can no longer feel and understand the difference between right and wrong. That's part of our genetic heritage. What the Jewish social engineering of the past three generations has instilled into us is a paralyzing fear that prevents us from acting. That's what you're going to have to beat. Now listen up here, guys, and listen good. The future of this planet depends upon the ability of a small group of men and women here and now in the early part of the 21st century to overcome that fear and to commit real-world acts in order to put a stop to the dictatorship. I'm going to devote the rest of my life to trying to make that happen, and so must you. This is Cyndi Lauper.
Sometimes I'm afraid when you go. Sometimes I'm afraid when you come home. Underneath it all, I think I'm afraid when there's nothing wrong. But if I was was rushing in. Sometimes I'm afraid of the dark. I can't find the light in my heart. I can feel my hand pushing away from your heart as I can. But if I was
In June of 2010, North Idaho attorney Edgar J. Steele was arrested by the FBI on false charges of allegedly hiring a hitman to murder his wife and mother-in-law. The alleged assassin was a man named Larry Fairfax, an FBI informer who was inserted into Steele's home posing as a handyman in order to spy on the Steele family until he saw the opportunity to help the Bureau destroy an outspoken critic of the regime. While he was working there, Fairfax proceeded to help himself to large stashes of silver coins and bullion that the Steeles were keeping on their property in anticipation of a Federal Reserve currency crash brought on by Barack Obama's incompetence. The final whereabouts of that silver seems to be something of a mystery. Apparently, the FBI allowed Fairfax to keep at least some of it as a kind of bonus or reparations for the annoyance and inconvenience of having to spend 16 months in a minimum security prison in the service of the Bureau. The basis of Edgar Steele's conviction were audio files fabricated by FBI technicians, supposedly discussions between himself and Fairfax about murder for hire. These conversations appear, even to a layman who first hears them, to sound strained, stilted, unnatural, and obviously doctored at the key points and phrases. The Steele tapes were not only forgeries, apparently they weren't even very good ones. At Steele's trial, two international audio engineering experts who were prepared to state categorically for the record that the tapes were fraudulent were barred from testifying by a corrupt judge. The jury was never allowed to hear evidence which clearly proved Edgar Steele's innocence. The situation wasn't helped by the fact that Steele's first attorney, a federal public defender named Roger Peavin, was a raging alcoholic who at the time was being sued by three members of his own legal staff for various acts of drunken misconduct. Steele's second defense attorney, a man named Robert McAllister, on whom he and his wife Cindy expended most of their life savings, turned out to be facing disbarment for embezzling his client's money, and was in fact disbarred only weeks after Steele's conviction. Many suspect that this second attorney may have struck a deal with the government to keep himself out of prison by deliberately taking a dive in the courtroom and bungling Steele's defense. If so, it didn't work. In September of 2012, the 62-year-old McAllister was sentenced to 6 years for fraud, so there's some comfort in hoping that the bent brief may die in the same prison cell as the client he betrayed. Interestingly enough, McAllister himself was a former United States attorney and prosecutor, which gives you some idea of the typical moral character of the people in the federal judiciary. For whatever reason, McAllister's performance in the courtroom was lackluster, to say the least, and he refused to put his client on the witness stand, which always looks very bad to a jury. Needless to say, the attorney's own perilous legal situation was never explained to either Ed or Cindy Steele while the trial was going on. As icing on the cake, I've spoken to persons present in the courtroom during the trial who have told me that Ed Steele, quote-unquote, looked like a zombie, confused and disoriented, and he seemed completely incoherent and disconnected from what was going on around him. The consensus of opinion was that Steele was drugged on orders from someone in the federal government to make sure that he was incapable of assisting in his own defense or even understanding what was happening to him. No one knows for sure why the federal government of the United States did this horrible thing to Edgar Steele. He must have pissed off somebody really bad, although I don't see how. Ed had announced plans to run for governor of Idaho, but he subsequently withdrew from the Idaho governor's race due to ill health. I have this horrible suspicion that the whole ghastly business may simply have been some kind of grotesque experiment on the part of the FBI, simply to see how far they could go and how much they could get away with in arresting and destroying critics of the regime. Edgar Steele is being held, we think, in the Victorville facility, which is well known throughout the federal system as a kind of toilet where human beings are flushed away. Among other things, the water supply in the prison is known to be contaminated with carcinogens and toxic waste, which facilitates the decline in health of those federal prisoners whom the government wishes to hear no more of. Victorville is notorious as an end-of-the-line destination. Once the gates clang shut there, nobody leaves except in a body bag. Edgar Steele has been sent there to die. It's now January of 2013. No one has, in fact, personally heard from Edgar Steele in almost 6 months now. His mail has been simply disappearing without response, and recently my own mail to Edgar started to be returned to me marked undeliverable as addressed. Since the triple-checked address is precisely the one listed on the Bureau of Prisons website for inmates, there is obviously something bad going on here. There's no way to tell what's happened to Ed. He may be in solitary, he may be in the infirmary, he may have been secretly moved to another prison, or he may be dead from his heart condition, or because the dictatorship simply murdered him in his cell one night. We have no way of knowing. I have also had Cindy Steele's present situation explained to me, and it's pretty damn vile, and it makes me even more ashamed than usual to be an American. Basically, my understanding is that some gentlemen in silk suits took Cindy aside and explained to her exactly what was going to happen, both to her and to her husband, if she didn't fall silent. And so far, it would appear that she's done so. As far as I'm aware, she has made no public statements or podcasts since the Freedom Palooza event of last year. I'm now going to play for you the final part of a podcast that Edgar Steele made in February of 2008. Now, you will note at the end of this segment how Ed comes out with the old no violence thing and tells people how if you just live your life openly and you don't break the law, you'll be okay. Well, we all know now how well that worked out for Ed. Now, this is especially ironic in view of what I myself was talking about earlier in this episode of Radio Free Northwest, but what can I tell you guys? We have a mission to carry out, and we're yellow dogs if we don't. And there really are no hard and fast rules anymore, apparently. I still have no idea why the dictatorship has decided to do what they did to Edgar Steele and not to me yet. Why Johnny Logan Spencer is in prison for a single poem, but I've gotten away with 5 novels. Why they choose to destroy some dissidents and ignore others. In a way, that's the scariest way to roll of all. Everything seemingly completely arbitrary. Never knowing what the rules are or where the lines are. Maybe they're doing that deliberately as another form of institutional terrorism. Who the hell knows what goes on in the worm-eaten minds of the people who rule us?
Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid allegedly head up the legislative branch of government, both of whom ascended to their current positions following the last midterm elections simply because the American people overwhelmingly demanded change and an end to the war in Iraq, not because of anything inherently worthy about their politics or leadership. However, the fact of one-party government was belied by Speaker Pelosi when she immediately put aside any possibility of George Bush being impeached for his many high crimes against the American public. U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice Roberts heads up the judicial branch, which has become as much a rubber stamp of executive action as anything ever seen under Franklin Roosevelt. The U.S. Federal Reserve Bank is private, not federal, has no reserves, and is not even really a bank in any sense of the word, and is the most direct and open expression of the globalists, who own its stock through complicated, nested, international, mostly foreign, corporate arrangements. More than anything else, it is the monetary policy of the execrable Fed, now headed by Whirly Ben Bernanke, but which did most of its damage under the leadership of Alan Greenspan, that is destroying America. Monetary policy is a euphemism, by the way, for legal counterfeiting, since it's the expansion of the money supply, the one trick of the Fed that really has led to the impoverishment of Americans, both now and into the future, by pure and simple theft. The fourth estate is best exemplified by media mogul Rupert Murdoch, who heads up Fox News, the stronghold mouthpiece of the new corporate elite, and others. Though every single media outlet of any significance is owned and operated by members of the same group about which Bill Clinton spoke, all neocon, all Zionist, mostly Jewish, traitors to America and our blood enemies, every single one of them. The people mentioned in these past few paragraphs, and just a few others, ladies and gentlemen, are the problem. They constitute what I call the axis of morons. It takes a towering intellect to build a towering house of cards, but all card houses have one thing in common. They fall. It is my fondest dream that one day we might witness their trials and public executions for the treason, genocide, and theft they committed while invested with the public good. None has said it better than David Rockefeller himself, founder of the Trilateral Commission, a Bilderberg member and board member of the Council on Foreign Relations, who said in his memoirs, quote, "Some even believe we are a part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists, and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure. One world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty and I'm proud of it." Close quote. Chutzpah. Amazing, isn't it? I consider it ironically symbolic that after 50 years, Marvel Comics now has decided to kill Captain America, who stood for everything good in America since the start of World War II. It's just too bad they didn't depict the Trigger Man as being David Rockefeller. Everything relates to the New World Order, one world government, globalism, whatever you wish to call it. Everything that is wrong with America today, everything that used to be so right about America, ties back into that single objective. America's preeminence must be destroyed so that she can take her place as just another country under sway of the globalist, self-chosen elite. Recall that while Bush the Elder introduced NAFTA, the beginning of what Ross Perot once called the giant sucking sound of American manufacturing and employment exiting the country. It was Bill Clinton who signed NAFTA into law, other alphabet soup organizations and agreements, for example, WTO, the World Trade Organization, NAU, the North American Union, ad nauseum, have continued to expand upon the pattern and objective of NAFTA. Clinton oversaw the systematic dismantling of American military power and allowed her secrets to be given over to America's future enemies, particularly China, both directly and through Israel. Bush the Lesser has overseen the destruction of American international influence and her domestic impoverishment. American self-determination, also known as nationalism, is being subverted by the mechanism of unchecked immigration, which dilutes the electorate, disempowering traditional white voters by replacing them both at the polling booth and in the workplace. It merely is a welcome bonus that our ruling corporate fascists thereby tap into a vast source of cheap labor, too. Thus, General Motors can offer buyouts of every single remaining hourly employee, which was announced in just the last week, so that they can be replaced by the cheaper labor that's been allowed to flood into the country. It doesn't matter a great deal in the case of General Motors anyway, because its days clearly are numbered, as evidenced by the record loss it just posted. The elite don't care about the effects upon the rest of us. The crime, disease, poverty, the hunger. After all, they live in exclusive gated communities, mostly abroad. Who are they, you ask? Good question. At this stage of the online version of today's piece, I give you a link to a list of their names, and I sincerely hope that someone will post their home addresses for our use when the time comes. Depression II and World War III are coming. In fact, I believe that history will record that both already have begun. For my complete take on both, as well as their causes, please see my book, Defensive Racism. In addition to the coming unpleasantry of war and economic apocalypse, add the likelihood of global disease pandemic, both natural and man-made, which will result in the globalist desired population reduction. I foresee a 20-80% population decline throughout, concentrated primarily in the poorer sections of the world. I see things ramping up ever more quickly from here, with things reaching a fever pitch no later than 2012. In fact, it could all be over rather quickly if global thermonuclear war develops, as I think likely, but with a mop-up period of abject misery that lasts for generations. So, what can we do? Nothing. Elections are useless in America to affect local, state, or national change, as now proven. If you must vote, vote against all incumbents, right down the line, including Dr. Paul. If he didn't have that congressional slot to which to return, he might have proven more adventurous, after all. The international cake already is in the oven and will explode no matter what we do. The dollar is doomed, and there is absolutely nothing that anybody can do about it. As I said at the outset, we're screwed. Violence? Much as I'd love to say, go get them and bring me their heads on pikes, truly, there's only one answer that I can give. Absolutely not. Anything else, of course, would get me arrested. Besides, it still is too early. Violent and or illegal acts done now simply would serve to delay the time when the average American will be willing to throw his or her lot in with ours. Notice that I assume you already are on the same page as I, since I doubt that hardly anybody not already there, other than our enemies, of course, will be listening to these words. Again, refer to my book, Defensive Racism, for active preparations. As in real estate, items 1 through 3 are location, location, and location, in that order. Get yourself out of the cities and into the country, preferably in a region that will be safe from whatever about which you might be paranoid. I personally am paranoid about police state action, financial devastation, infrastructure breakdown, nuclear strikes, nuclear fallout, racial strife, earthquake, volcanoes, tidal waves, and hurricanes. And not necessarily in that order. That's why I live in North Idaho, one of the very few areas in America likely to be free from the initial effects, at least, of nuclear fallout. In the country, with the well, and a little acreage on which we grow livestock and could grow modest crops. Next, arm yourself well, with plenty of reserves of ammunition to protect yourself and your family. Bury some of your guns as gun confiscation is coming. Next, put up substantial stores of basic foodstuffs, enough to get your family by for a year, ideally. And finally, protect yourself financially, if you are fortunate enough to have any money left over from the real priority items. Get out of all dollar-denominated assets and into something designed to weather the coming financial storm, which already is in progress. Check my archives for articles aplenty on this topic. Cultivate like-minded friends, but avoid those who advocate violence or who might seem a bubble or two off-center. Don't worry about federal agents. They're everywhere. Live your life right out in the open. Keep your head down and do nothing illegal, and you likely will avoid their wrath, if not their pettiness. Our day will come, rest assured, and all too soon, the day they start shooting us down in the streets, the day we start shooting back. Then will be the time to retake America. Then will be the time to even scores and settle accounts. Then we begin the long journey back toward freedom and a constitutional republic. New America. An idea whose time has come. My name is Edgar J. Steele. Thanks for listening. Please visit my website, conspiracypenpal.com, for other messages, just like this one.
I remember how I occasionally refer on the show to the Jacobites, and no, I won't bother to explain again what a Jacobite was, but I've got another Jacobite song for you. Now, this is a song in both English and Scots Gaelic about Bonnie Prince Charlie, done in a kind of Celtic rock fusion by the Chieftains and Sting. Any association between Sting and Bonnie Prince Charlie is kind of a bizarre concept, but this isn't a bad number.
Shemalek ma'ilama, shemahezahil ma, sona shenevorasfet, hakuig again ma'ilama. Spirit and with mind afraid, so wish him strength and length of days.
Shema Yerama, Shema Yerama, Sona
If I can wander back onto a topic that I was addressing earlier in the show, I understand that as we begin the process of transforming this Northwest idea from something that exists only on the pages of my novels and bringing it to birth as something that has a real world existence among real people outside the printed page and outside the internet, striking the balance between open and covert action of the kind that's going to be necessary to bring this idea to the attention of the white people who need to hear it on the one hand, and security and effectiveness on the other, that's going to be difficult. Now, I'm often asked to define the difference between legitimate security consciousness and paranoia, and I'm sure that a lot of you remember my standard canned answer to that question, but it's spaced repetition time again, so here goes. Legitimate security consciousness helps you to function politically and propaganda-wise. Paranoia prevents you from functioning. Now, practically speaking, if you spend a day or a week or a month or a year doing things that bring people to northwestfront.org, doing things that gets them to listen to Radio Free Northwest, that gets them reading the Northwest novels, and you don't lose your job and get arrested or get your car vandalized or get TV cameras shoved in your face when you step out the door in the morning, then you're striking the right balance. But there has to be that crucial element of effectiveness in there. Remember, the problem with leaderless resistance was that it eventually turned out to be all leaderless and no resistance. If you end up hiding behind your computer or in your closet, like I know one guy did quite literally when some people tracked down his physical address off the internet and came knocking at his door, now if you stop doing what you're doing because you're afraid or because someone threatens you, then you've let paranoia win. Now let me repeat yet again that the Northwest Front is a legal movement which must act as if it is an illegal one. We have to do that because white nationalists of any kind, and white separatists especially, are a persecuted minority. And I say white separatists specifically because the secret police seem to make a special effort to track down those of us who attempt to separate ourselves from the loving embrace of Obama the Messiah and drag us out of whatever compound or cabin in the piney woods we're hiding in. No one is allowed to go off in a corner and do their own thing. No one is allowed to go their own way. For a long time now, and even more so in the one-party dictatorship to come, everybody has to march to the beat of the same drummer, kind of like the drummer on the stern of the old slave galleys who beat the time for the rowers. The fact that we still, in theory, have a legal and a constitutional right to be different, and to think differently, and to live differently, that simply doesn't matter anymore. The Constitution doesn't matter anymore, and the law doesn't matter anymore, because Obama and his dogs have found out that they can do whatever they want, and no one will do anything about it. Now, this is the key to understanding the situation we're in. Legal politics would still have a chance in this country if only we had some way to compel the government of the United States and its armed men to obey their own laws. To not do things like fabricated audio tapes about hitmen so that a 67-year-old man that somebody in the regime doesn't like will die all alone in prison. You know, not do stuff like that. But we don't have any way to force these people to obey their own rules and comply with the law, except the one furnished by the Founding Fathers in the form of the Second Amendment, which we are too timid and frightened to use for fear that the bad men in the blue uniforms and the black body armor might hurt us. Now, the fact that we allow ourselves to be ruled by fear and laziness is contemptible, but it doesn't excuse the government of the United States, which, in fact, rules by fear. Okay, now here's one of those points that occurs in all my podcasts where I have to choose my words very, very carefully so that the U.S. attorneys and the FBI agents who are leaning down with their ears next to the speakers, listening with bated breath to my every word to see if they can find something to prosecute me for. Anyway, I don't want them deciding that I'm trying to quote-unquote incite something. Now, this isn't incitement. Hell, it can't be. If American white people were capable of being incited to anything by anybody, we wouldn't be in this mess right now. They would have taken care of the problem long ago. Let's just call this a kind of a philosophical digression, which, considering the character of white Americans, is actually all it really is. Yeah, really. Of course, whether the slowly shrinking parameters of speech acceptable to the dictatorship allows me something like philosophical digressions, I don't know. I know we're not allowed to have a sense of humor, and we're not allowed to make jokes at the expense of the dictator, and I know we're not allowed to post poetry to the internet, which is critical of the dictator. And I know that we're not allowed to name the names of any of the dictator's slimier accomplices. But are we allowed to philosophize still? I don't know. This week, maybe. Next week, who knows? I guess if I hear the sound of my door splintering in the dawn and the screaming of cowards in black masks armed with the kind of guns that we're no longer allowed to have, I'll know, won't I? Sorry, I'm rambling. Anyway, what I wanted to philosophize about is this. Why do the people in this society with power, any kind of power from the dictator himself on down to the Dilbert-esque pointy-haired boss who wields petty power in most of our workplaces, anyway, why do these people constantly do such horrible, wicked things? Why do the people in America with all the power always seem to be such weasels, such thieves and pathological liars, in some cases downright psychopaths? Why can they not use that power for good? Is there some unwritten law that says that anyone in a liberal democracy with a little bit of actual power over other people's lives has to be a braying jackass and a half-insane obsessive who has to get his way or he starts doing harm? Why must their power always be used to harm white people in some way, especially white males? Okay, I'm minded of a few lines of dialogue from George Orwell's immortal novel 1984. One of the famous scenes towards the end of the book where Winston Smith is being tortured in the Ministry of Love by O'Brien, and O'Brien tackles this issue. I won't read out the exact excerpt, but basically Winston asks the same question. With all the powers that English socialism and Big Brother have, why must it all be used for evil? Why not use that power to actually solve problems and make a better life for everyone, like Obama could do if he was so inclined? Now, why must the power of the left always be used for torture, for starving and keeping millions of people living in a kind of weird Marxist Dickensian misery? Why does their power have to be used for 24-hour spying? Why does their power have to be used to propagate massive lies and the rewriting of history and for the suppression of dissent? All this starting to sound a bit familiar, by the way. Anyway, O'Brien answers that the goal of the Marxist dictatorship of Big Brother is power. Power over human beings. And yes, Orwell meant Marxism in his novel. He was a former communist himself, and his description of Big Brother on the posters is identical to that of Stalin. Now, the goal of the Jewish liberal left, be it Stalinist communism or Obama's Marxism-like version, is to achieve power over human beings and power to control their lives. The power, for example, that Michelle Obama exercises when she tells high school and junior high school kids what they can eat and reduces their school lunches to 700 calories of rabbit food. The kind of power that bans certain light bulbs. The power that sends people who smoke outside into the rain and the wind and the winter cold so that they suffer physical discomfort and maybe illness, while the non-smoking liberal Democrats of the ruling party remain safe and warm indoors. That kind of petty PC. And it's only going to get worse in the coming years. To enforce this control, this power to tell other people how to live their lives, the Marxists and Jews and judges and U.S. attorneys and FBI agents and media personalities and the prison system and whatnot who wield that power in the name of the dictator have to get their rush off it as well. Now, many of these people who take the dictator's direct deposit every month do so not only because of the money and the medical insurance and a prospect of a 401k that the Democrats won't steal, but because they enjoy exercising power over other human beings, the power to tell them how to live their lives, what they can do in their own homes, and in some cases the power to take all their wealth and destroy those lives, sometimes, as in the case of Edgar Steele, the power to commit murder. And the answer that O'Brien gave to Winston Smith back in the novel 1984 is this. How do you know that you are truly exercising power over another human being? By making them suffer. Because if they aren't suffering, how do you know that they're doing whatever it is they're doing, not because you desire it, but because they desire it themselves? Now, this is what Barack Hussein Obama and those who serve him have discovered, that they can not only tell white people how to live their lives, but they can make white people suffer. And no one will do anything about it. It is crucial to understand this. There are now no remaining restraints at all on the government and its employees, or as Al Gore put it when someone tried to stop him from committing some bad act he wanted to do, there is, quote-unquote, no controlling legal authority. So look at it from the viewpoint of an FBI agent, or a prison guard, or a judge, or a U.S. attorney, or other kind of lawyer, or a bureaucrat, or a media personality, or a congressman, or a union leader, or a so-called community organizer like Obama used to be, or someone in a corporate boardroom. Why exactly should they not do something that hurts a white man or a woman, or their family, or which hurts hundreds of thousands of millions, something that deprives white people of their life savings? Something that takes away their job, takes away their home, takes away a white man's family, something that sends a 67-year-old man to die in prison for a crime that everyone within the system knows perfectly well he didn't commit. Come on, why not? Really, think about this, why not? There is no disincentive at all in this country not to be a tyrant and an oppressor and a vile dog who walks on 2 feet. But, and this is where my little homily is going to get a bit ticklish here, but suppose there was a disincentive, I mean. Just suppose, now, that when the men and the women who rule the society got up in the morning and prepared for their day of high-level board meetings, or courtroom appearances, or committee hearings, or television appearances, or movie-making, or financial wheeling and dealing, or just plain doing their shift as a police officer, or a corrections officer, or a federal agent. Suppose, just suppose, that there was at least some degree of disincentive to spend that day stamping on white faces with a steel boot, as O'Brien put it in 1984. Just suppose now that these people understood that if they fucked over a white man or a white family or broke the law or violated the Constitution of the United States, then they, yes, them, they themselves, might be held personally accountable. Would that make any difference in their behavior? I don't know. Do I dare to speculate if it would make any difference in these people's behavior? I don't know. Is the whole concept of personal accountability for the dictator's servants now beyond the acceptable parameters of discussion? Something like the N-word and the F-word that white boys are forbidden to utter so that we won't have the words to formulate the thought? I don't know. Like I said, I guess I'll find out when I hear my door crashing open in the dawn.
Whatever you say, say nothing. When you talk about you know what, or if you know who should hear, you know what you'll get. It'll take you off to you know where, you wouldn't know how long. So for you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you sing it, sing it all. And whatever you say, say nothing. When you talk about you know what, or if you know who should hear, you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you singing this song. You all know what I'm speaking of when I mention you know what, and I fear it's very dangerous to even mention that, for the other ones are always near, although you may not see, and if anyone asks who told you that, please don't mention me. And whatever you say, say nothing. When you talk about you know what, or if you know who should hear, you know what you'll get. They'll take you off, you know where, but you wouldn't know how long. So for you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you singing this song. You all know who I'm speaking of when I mention you know who, or if you know who should hear you, you know what he do. So if you don't see me again, you'll know why I'm away. And if anyone asks you where I've gone, here's what you must say. Whatever you say, say nothing. When you talk about you know what, or if you know who should hear you, you know what you'll get. They'll take you off, you know where, but you wouldn't know how long. So for you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you singing this song. About so-and-so, not to mention such-and-such. And I'd better end my song, I've already said too much. For the less you say and the less you hear, the less you'll go astray. And the less you think and the less you do, the more you'll hear them say. Oh, whatever you say, say nothing. Come on, when you talk about you know what, or if you know who say, yeah, you know what you'll get. Oh, they'll take you off, you know where, but you wouldn't know how long. So for you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you singing this song. And whatever you say, say nothing. When you talk about you know what, or if you know who should hear you, you know what you'll get. They'll take you off to you know where, for you wouldn't know how long. So for you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you singing this song. And whatever you say, say nothing. When you talk about you know what, or if you know who should hear you, you know what you'll get. They'll take you off, you know where, but you wouldn't know how long. So for you know who's sake, don't let it.
sake, don't let anyone hear you singing this song.
Right, I have an email here from Christina in Minnesota, who asks me to describe this alleged youthful national organizer I keep talking about for the Northwest Front, and could such a person be a woman? Yes, in theory it could be a woman, although realistically we're most likely looking for a man in his 30s, very late 20s minimum, more likely about 35, I'd say. I base this on what appears to be the current rate at which young white males who survive their teens and early 20s with their minds and personalities intact mature to something approaching responsible adulthood. And no, I'm not being funny. I'm being dead serious. Optimum, we're looking for a man in good health who is between 32 and 35 years old, which will mean that he is sufficiently mature and capable of making an adult lifetime commitment to the Northwest Republic, but he still has plenty of tread left on the tire. I would consider someone in their very early 40s, but beyond about 45, the health problems start kicking in. Plus, if he's that old, he's probably been involved with the 1990s movement or even earlier, and he may have picked up some bad baggage and bad habits. I'm looking for a very specific skill set here, and really nothing else will do. The best way I can put it is that I am looking for me at age 25. Now, I know that a lot of stuff I do may not seem like quote-unquote real work for those of you to whom that term means going out with a lunch pail at dawn and going to some big hangar or site where you lift heavy crap and bang on metal things all day. But I assure you that what I do is just as time-consuming and in its own way just as exhausting as any manual labor job you care to name. It takes an immense amount of effort just to run a kitchen table operation like the Northwest Front. And my job is like a lot of others. Everybody thinks he could do it really easy, until he actually tries it. So, what would this national organizer do? Well, to start with, he would be our people person. As long as I'm being buried alive by what's basically routine administrative and maintenance stuff, I am not concentrating on the big picture. And not only that, but I'm not giving the kind of attention to any of it that it deserves. I have to get some help here in the form of someone to come in here and mostly deal with all these people who are hollering for my attention. Someone who is not only an assistant, but who is essentially my understudy and who can deputize for me in most things. Now, you might say I'm like a businessman looking for a promising young man to teach the trade so that I can semi-retire and spend my remaining time doing the creative stuff. Now, you can see why I can't just give this job to an internet walk-in. This is not a case where somebody just rocks up on my doorstep and gets handed the keys to the kingdom 6 months later, such as the kingdom is. There are some very promising-looking people coming into contact with the Northwest Front right now, and I have high hopes for some of them. But some of them aren't even in the homeland yet, and most of them are simply too new. They have no track record yet, and I have to have some assurance that they won't lose interest in a few months and wander off looking for other entertainment, which is something that's happened in the past. The national organizer has to be in it for the long haul. Now, this is a position that will require years of investment and trust and training. And time is short in every sense of the term. For that reason, this person needs to make his appearance on the scene very soon, so that we can begin the process of building those years of trust and experience. Now, I need to describe what this assistant-type person will have to do, and what kind of individual he will have to be, and even more to the point, what he cannot be. Now, this person must have at least 25 or 30 years or so of tread left on the tire. I'm sorry to keep on harping on this, but it is very important, almost overridingly important, that this person must be at least 20 years younger than I am. Because like all understudies, he will eventually have to step forward and take up a large part of my role. At first, relieve me to do the creative stuff, and then later on when I peg out. There are a few good men in the movement right now whom I would trust to do this job and who might even be persuaded to take it on, but the problem is that they're all my age or older, and mostly they're in even worse health. There are a few in the middle range, but they have families and responsibilities, and whoever steps into my shoes must be able to commit his full time to the Northwest Republic with no distractions and no competition for his attention. There is no point in my training somebody to take over my responsibilities who, even if he survives my removal from the scene, is going to be too old and sick to function, and who'll have to worry almost immediately about training a successor of his own. The Northwest Movement cannot be led by a doddering old man, any more than a revolution can be carried out by the Tea Party people with their canes, their denture cream, and their wheelchairs. This sorcerer's apprentice type will have to know everything that I know. He will have to be able to do everything that I can do, and hopefully a lot of stuff that I can't do, especially when it comes to computers and technology. He'll have to function as my alter ego and deal with the day-to-day NF grind while I set up my ivory tower and create. He must be diplomatic. I especially can't have anybody with an abrasive personality who's going to alienate our financial donors. He must master the technology needed to become an internet media personality in his own right. This adjutant or aide of mine will eventually have to speak for me, in some cases in public, so he'll have to be sharp as a tack and able to think on his feet. He may even have to stand for public office someday, so it would really help if he were photogenic. Now, those of you who have seen my YouTubes know that I look like somebody found me in a local homeless shelter. This national organizer's closet must be completely free of skeletons. He cannot have something, anything in his past that the media will batter him with every time he shows his face in public. No criminal record, no messy divorces with all kinds of nasty things lying around in court records, not the remotest hint of alcoholism or drug use, not so much as a whisper of any weird sex stuff. None of the bizarre, dysfunctional shit that most white Americans start accumulating in their teenaged years. No DUIs, no shady business dealings, no quirky incidents leading to loss of employment, no weird religious mania, no history of psychiatric care or antipsychotic drugs or anything like that. Not one breath of scandal or oddity. Now, most of you people have never seen a media feeding frenzy. I have. And if you have one small, single, bleeding cut in your life they can tear and worry at, they will pull it open and rip you to pieces like piranhas. Ask Sarah Palin, ask Christine O'Donnell, ask Mitt Romney, who may have lost the election because the media convinced a bunch of bird brains that he hated dogs and murdered some guy's wife. I will need to trust this national organizer implicitly in all things. He must be physically here at my side, not sitting behind a computer hundreds of miles away. He will be someone whose actual face I see every day. He will be a genuine political soldier. He will devote every waking hour that he is not working his own outside job to support himself to the Northwest Front. And when the time comes, when the party can afford to maintain not one but two people on a tenuous full-time basis, he will quit his job to devote every waking hour to the Northwest American Republic. And from that point on, he will live poor as a church mouse. Like me, he will dress out of Walmart and Goodwill and live on the edge of the abyss, one cut above destitution and homelessness. He will live in the shadow of the Salvation Army shelter for decades if necessary, as I have done, because he understands that the 14 words are more important than his personal welfare. Now, for the record, Christina, I am not absolutely ruling out a woman, but we need to be realistic here. The kind of white male I am describing here is as rare as hen's teeth. I don't want to say that that kind of white woman just simply doesn't exist anymore, because I'm sure in the 230 million white people out there, there may well be one or two left. But insofar as any practical chance of our ever locating and motivating such a person, probably not. You can't ever really find the needle in a haystack, you know. Finding a woman like that would be sheer unadulterated luck, and that's not something we can count on. The trouble is, the same requirements would apply to a female national organizer as well as a male, including the age requirement, so I wouldn't be able to make do with some little old lady in tennis shoes. Like a male assistant, she would need a minimum of 25 to 30 years of tread left on her tire. Like a male assistant, her closet would have to be completely free of skeletons, and in this horrible, unnatural world we live in, white women are often even more damaged than the men, although in different ways. Who knows? We may get lucky, but it's really a long shot. Okay, now given the unlikelihood of our finding such a person anywhere near soon enough to do me any immediate good, what would I be willing to settle for? Because I do understand I'll probably have to settle. I suppose that in exchange for some help sooner rather than later, I could be a little flexible on the age requirement. Homer Simpson, maybe, but not Grandpa. I will also probably have to be somewhat broader in my definition of what constitutes an acceptable track record than I have been, because I'm simply getting overwhelmed here. This person cannot be a complete newbie that nobody knows and nobody's ever heard of. For real though, guys, the rubber is going to meet the road soon, and this guy is still wandering around out there with no idea we even exist. I need you to find him for me soon. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.